Welcome to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. Three people have applied to fill a vacant seat on the Sioux City School Board. That's because board member Mike Crizzle resigned on June 18th, saying he was physically and mentally worn out after a series of budget challenges and controversies. On June 28th, the school board published an official notice starting a two-week process for people to petition instead of holding a special election. It's likely the school board will select the new board member at the July 16th board meeting. The candidates are John Myers, Mayuki Nelson, and Monique Scarlett. John Myers is a former school board member who has also worked for the city of Sioux City. Myers says in order for the community of Sioux City to succeed, we need good schools, and he'd like to help make that happen.
And that's why I've been interested in it over the years. Before I served 8 years on the school board, I served for over 30 years in public financial management, 29 of those years as Sioux City finance director. I believe that my financial management skills are helpful to the district, especially as the district faces a number of years of costs going up faster than available revenue.
That has really been a big problem for this school district, as well as many other school districts across Iowa. And those are the kinds of challenges you're interested in working on?
Believe it or not, yes. I'm good at it. Being with the city, there were a number of years where we had to make some very difficult budget adjustments. We did that. It's not much fun, but it is something that you have to do in order to provide the best possible services at a price that the citizens can afford and that the state will allow.
When you hear people talk about the school board meetings, people come to the school board meetings and complain. How do you deal with that when people are visibly concerned, sometimes upset about some of the things going on?
Well, the first thing you do is you listen to them. That's probably the single most important thing to do. And then if there's something that that is obviously wrong and the board or the superintendent can do something about it, we discuss that matter with the administration and see how we can make things better. That's about the best that we can do. We can't get into a long discussion with people on items that aren't on the agenda, but we can certainly listen and think about it and see if we can find something that will make life better for some people without making it worse for others.
You have a lot of experience in this area, both in the school board area and in the city. So many people have said this last year or so has been controversial with a lot of financial pressures. Is it worse than it's been before, or is this kind of typical?
Well, it's typical in the sense that every year that I've been on the board, we've had financial challenges. Revenue has been less than expenses, so we've had to cut almost every year. And you go back the next year and the next year and the next year, each year cutting more than what you did the previous years because you thought what was kept was important, but then you can't pay for these important things. So you go back and you constantly look at what you can reduce while keeping in mind that the budget has to be sustainable. And you can't cut things, for 1 year, like textbooks, for example, and then the next year comes around, you don't have any money for textbooks or curriculum, and you're in worse shape than you were before. So you have to think about what you're doing so that it's sustainable and can be replicated over the years, because there's no evidence that things are going to get better, at least in the short term.
It's tough because people want the best for their children.
Well, of course they do. That's normal, and it's something that I want for the community, too, is the best that we can possibly do. But the state tells us how much we can spend and gives us a lot of rules on how to spend it. And within that, we have to move around and adjust things as best we can to deal with circumstance. Oftentimes, you're not dealing with exactly the hand of cards that you would prefer, but they're there, so you do the best you can. That I've been a public servant for over 40 years between city government and the school board. I'm pretty good at it. I am only asking to fill the last year of President Creasel's term. I'm not going to run again for a four-year term. At my age, I don't feel that would be appropriate, but I can certainly serve for a year and finish up his term, I think, pretty well.
And that was former school board member John Myers. Also, I talked with Monique Scarlett, who is a wealth management client representative at U.S. Bank, but she also serves on the Sioux City Human Rights Commission. Scarlett says she'd like to serve on the school board as part of her continuing public service.
I'm committed and passionate for building and sustaining a school board that will listen, learn, build, and serve our public school system. I intend to accomplish this by keeping our teachers and students and administration forefront. So that is the reason that I want to be on the board. It is about building our public school system in the way it should be. Not that there's much wrong at this time, but there's always room for improvement. And I think I am that individual that will come on board and bring more transparency, bring more strength.
Do you think that the school board needs to be more transparent? Are you concerned about some of the budgeting issues?
Well, I'm concerned probably about all of those. I have questions and concerns, and so I like to get more information, do more research. I have talked with school board members in the past based on their votes and what the data was. And so I am a little concerned about some votes that have gone the way they have. However, I always want to do my research, get the information so that I can make the informed decision. And I bring that transparency. I have that due diligence that I will do my research before making any type of vote.
What do you think your work on the Human Rights Commission helps you bring to the school board?
Being a commissioner for three consecutive terms has been a huge asset, an eye-opener to not only the diversity and inclusion, but just to Sioux City by itself. I mean, the community has grown leaps and bounds. We're now considered a melting pot. And I was born and raised here. I never thought I would see that, but it is great to see the diversity. It's great to learn and appreciate the different ethnicities and taking out the time to learn about different cultures and learning how to bring all of that together and work as one city. So that has just been a plus. The director and the commissioners, the team that I serve with, was always engaged and always hands-on. I want people to know that I have done a lot more than just serve on the Human Rights Commission. I want people to know that I'm a proud graduate of West High, class of 85. I've raised two sons. They graduated from North High, and I bring financial experience with over 20 years of banking. I have at-risk youth experience, diversity experience, of course, with the Human Rights Commission, and also a member of the NAACP for well over 25 years. I'm also the founder of the Unity in the Community, which embraces and builds relationships with citizens and law enforcement. And I've also been hands-on with hundreds of students in our public schools with the Better Choices, Better Community workshops and choir, and that had derived from Mount Zion Church. So I've always had an outreach with our young people, always had a working relationship with our public school system. It's time to take it to a higher level.
And that was Monique Scarlett, who's also a candidate for that open Sioux City School Board seat. And now we hear from Mayuki Nelson. She believes she would be a good board member because she volunteers on the District Advisory Committee, and she's also ran for the school board before. Nelson says she's also been working at her son's school since he's been in kindergarten.
You know, I've been very welcomed at the school level as far as being able to volunteer for different events or being able to help in the classroom. And, you know, I've been actually been allowed to even provide enrichment activities for the kids. You know, one of the things I'm really proud of is the Lego Robotics Club that we started, which is also one of the things that that was shared at a Good News report a couple of years ago. And just being able to carry out initiatives that are beneficial for the school, for the teachers, and they provide an opportunity for parents to get engaged. Another reason I think I would be a good candidate is I've been involved not only at the school level, but as well as the district level. And the two different committees that I serve in, the District Advisory Committee. I've had the pleasure to chair those, the District Advisory Committee, for the past 2 years. And I'm also a member of the Equity Committee.
Can you tell me a little bit about what you've been doing on the District Advisory Committee?
You get to see and provide feedback and provide advice and guidance to the school district on student achievement, which is something that I think just always needs to be improved, always needs to be worked on. I mean, that is the sole purpose, I believe, of the school district, to ensure the kids actually do achieve, believe, and succeed. With being involved in those two committees, I feel like I've gotten an opportunity to see some of the mechanics behind the scenes that a lot of people don't look at, and really understand how things kind of work from an administrative and a standpoint, and then be able to kind of provide a different perspective. And, you know, the District Advisory Committee, again, is kind of unique in that it's made up of parents, community members, staff members, and students. And students always provide a very unique perspective on the different things that we look at, and specifically have very detailed ideas on how to improve student achievement. So they bring a wealth of information, and the committee actually works really well to kind of enhance and, again, provide feedback to the school district on things that kind of tie to the strategic goals for the school district.
And the District Advisory Committee just presented a year-end review to the school board.
Some of the things that we wanted to tackle was Wi-Fi equity. A lot of our older students don't have the opportunity to have Wi-Fi in their homes, and that's a little bit of a setback. And, you know, as you know, everything is computerized and technology-based and internet-based. So it is important for those students to be able to have that. So the committee has decided that they would like to work with the school district as well as the service provider on figuring out ways to have Wi-Fi safe areas for students. At the same time, the committee also recognizes that that's only one portion of student achievement, and the committee really delved into what are the things that we need to make children successful from the beginning. So really interested in improving awareness for early childhood literacy, as well as improving, you know, the ability of parents to understand, hey, you know, literacy is not only reading a book, it's also speaking to your child and building with your child vocabulary.
And that was Mayuki Nelson, one of three candidates who would like to fill out the remaining year of retiring school board member Mike Crissell's term. The school board will hear from all three candidates at its next meeting on July 16th, and then they'll vote and choose the next school board member. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. Last week, we celebrated the 4th of July and the role that General and later President George Washington played in the founding of our country. But Washington was not a proponent of independence for his slaves. In fact, he spent several years attempting to deny liberty to one of them. This story is told in the book Never Caught, The Washington's Relentless Pursuit of Their Runaway Slave, Ona Judge. It's written by Professor of Black Studies and History at the University of Delaware, Erica Armstrong Dunbar. Armstrong Dunbar says she was working on another book project in the archives of Philadelphia when she came across an odd runaway slave advertisement in an old newspaper. And what struck her was that it came from the President of the United States.
And I thought, whoa, wait a minute. Of course, the nation's capital at that moment was in Pennsylvania, in Philadelphia. And who on earth was George Washington looking for? And the advertisement was very clear that they were looking for a runaway who they called Oney Judge. And in all of the records at Mount Vernon, they refer to her as Oney. I call her Ona, which is the name she went by at the end of her life as a sort of marker of adult dignity. But they were looking for Oney, who was a 20-ish year old woman who had escaped from the president's house. And I thought, okay, who is this woman? Why don't I know her story? What happened to her? And that really sort of led me on the path to eventually write Never Caught. I thought maybe I'll figure out a way to put this in the book that I was working on. And I said, no, I'm going to come back to this captivating story.
And she came into Washington's household after he married Martha, because I believe she owned by the Custis family?
Technically, Ona was owned by Martha Washington and her estate. So Martha Washington was, of course, married once before George Washington. She was widowed. And her estate was really to be given to her during her lifetime and then to her heirs. So any children and grandchildren that Martha had with her first husband would be privy to any of the property from the estate, including human property. So Ona was technically owned by Martha Washington. However, in the 18th century, the estate of a woman was typically run by and managed by her husband. And so while Ona technically belonged to Martha Washington, George Washington was in charge of the estate and was responsible for all of the enslaved, whether he owned them outright or Martha Washington.
And Ona was highly valued, apparently, on a personal level, because she worked directly with Martha Washington in the house. And did that sort of make a difference in how her quote-unquote owners saw her?
Yeah, I think that Ona, like other children at the age of 10, was brought up to work in the mansion house at Mount Vernon. She's born in 1773, 74. We don't have an exact date because the Washingtons did not keep records of birth dates of the enslaved. But we know that she was born sometime at the sort of beginning of this revolutionary era. At the age of 10, she's brought up to work at the mansion house. And she's really brought up to do what her mother had been doing, which is her mother was a seamstress. Her mother had the name of Betty, and she was a seamstress and a spinner. And so Ona was to come and to learn those skills between the age of 10 and 16 or so. She becomes basically Martha Washington's chosen sort of top slave, for the lack of a better term. She's Martha Washington's go-to person, meaning she is responsible for the most intimate of responsibilities with Martha, helping her bathe, helping her brush her hair, making her clothing, and sort of tending to her every need.
And she ended up going with the Washingtons to Philadelphia mainly because Washington became president. Is that right?
In 1789, Washington was elected president, and actually, the nation's capital, of course, was at first in New York, and so the Washingtons chose to bring seven enslaved people with them to New York, and Ona Judge was one of them. And slavery in New York in 1789 was not odd. It was something, there were many, many enslaved people in New York, as well as a growing population of free people. And it really isn't until the 1790, the nation's capital moves to Philadelphia, the Washingtons move as well, and they actually bring with them, they'll have nine enslaved people living in their home in Philadelphia. And this is a different, very different environment than New York. Slavery, in part because of a large Quaker presence and other factors, slavery was really on its deathbed by the 1790s. So that when Ona arrives, she's really one of maybe 100 or so enslaved people in Philadelphia. And there are 6,000-7,000 free blacks in that area. So the Washingtons made the choice to bring enslaved people with them to the nation's capital in Philadelphia, in a state that had decided to rid itself of human bondage. And they were very, very clear that they preferred to have enslaved men and women serving them. So although they were moving to a place in which slavery was really on the sort of cusp of being unacceptable, that didn't matter to the Washingtons. They brought their slaves with them.
You're listening to The Exchange. I'm Mary Hartnett. I'm talking with Erica Armstrong Dunbar, the author of Never Caught, The Washington's Relentless Pursuit of Their Runaway Slave, Ona Judge. So what were the rules for slaves? I believe it was quite a specific rule about how long an enslaved person could be in that state. I don't know if it was in the state of Pennsylvania or in Philadelphia before they would change their status.
That for non-residents, for people like the Washingtons, who were visiting or staying on sort of an extended period of vacationing or visiting in the state of Pennsylvania, that they could bring enslaved people with them, but they could only stay for up to 6 months. And if they stayed over that six-month period, their enslaved men and women were to be emancipated, that they could gain their freedom if their owners overstayed that six-month period. And so there's this moment when the Washingtons, actually George Washington thinks that he's sort of exempt from this law because it's the seat of the nation's, it's the nation's capital, it's the seat of power. He was there on business, and so he thought that he was exempt. Congress was exempt from this law, but that did not apply to him. And so the Attorney General actually visits the Washington household, and George Washington is off on a southern tour, but Martha Washington, as well as his secretary, Tobias Lear, were there to receive the visit, and basically the Attorney General tells him, look, you're at risk of losing your slaves. It just happened to me. My slaves told me they'd been here for longer than 6 months and that they were free. And so there's this moment where you see, you know, the unlettered enslaved men and women telling the Attorney General the law, and he actually loses his slaves. And he's telling the Washingtons, look, be careful. You are in the same situation as I. And so there's a set of letters that go back and forth to George Washington, between George Washington and Tobias Lear's secretary. And it's at this moment that Washington comes up with basically his slave rotation plan. And he tells his secretary that we will rotate our slaves in and out of the state of Pennsylvania every 6 months. And if it's too difficult to make a trip back to Virginia, we will travel to New Jersey across the river. A quick trip to Trenton will suffice. And basically says in his letter, I wish to do this to deceive them, meaning the slaves, and the public. So he's very clear that he wants this kind of slave rotation plan to remain discreet, that he knew that while he wasn't breaking the law in Pennsylvania, he was clearly breaking the spirit of the law, and for that reason wanted to keep this discreet.
And it sounds like Ona, she understood this, and she also understood that she was in danger of losing her opportunity to be free, because wasn't she going to be handed over to one of Martha Washington's relatives?
It would have been virtually impossible for the enslaved living in the president's household to not know the law. We know that one of their enslaved men, Hercules, who was a sort of famed chef, he knew the law, and it would have been very odd for the others to not know it. However, you know, to run away, the act of running away, the act of leaving one's family members behind, knowing that you'd probably never see them again, that was a huge undertaking. And for Ona, it becomes a necessity once she learns that she is going to be given away as a wedding gift to Martha Washington's granddaughter by the name of Eliza Parker Custis. She's basically going to be given to her in order to help her transition to the new role as a wife and eventually a mother. And Ona knew this woman. Ona knew Eliza, and she had knew that she was difficult, and she was had a reputation for being volcanic in her temperament, and really understood that her life would most likely be doomed to one of misery if she did not take this moment to flee. So when pushed, she makes the decision to escape. And on May 21st, 1796, while the Washingtons ate their supper, she left the Washingtons' household and never returned.
After all of Washington's efforts with the rotation and all these thought-out plans, it just seems almost unbelievable that they're complacently sitting there having dinner and it's the evening, and she just slips out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's part of this, of course, was that Ona's responsibilities, caring for Martha, traveling with her on her social visits and what have you, you know, that kept Ona very, very busy. But there was one thing from which Ona was really exempt in terms of labor, and that was mealtime. There was a staff of servants and enslaved people, white and black, who were responsible for dinner and lunch and breakfast. And this was important in the 18th century, especially for someone like George Washington, a man who came into office with one tooth in his mouth. So to have a chef and a staff that knew what he could actually eat was important. And Ona was not a part of that sort of team of slaves and servants. So this really would have been the only moment during the day that she could have escaped and sort of not been looked for at that moment. And she used that opportunity. And with the help of the free black community, she was able to escape while they were eating their supper. We don't know when the Washingtons realize that she's gone, but eventually they do. And she escapes on a Saturday. By Monday, they're advertising for her in the newspaper.
You're listening to The Exchange. I'm Mary Hartnett. I'm talking with Erica Armstrong Dunbar, the author of Never Caught, The Washingtons' Relentless Pursuit of Their Runaway Slave, Ona Judge. I was really struck by the president's being so upset about this, what he was calling sort of the lack of appreciation that Ona had for everything they had done for her. And to us today, thinking, well, she was he made her as a slave. He kept her as a slave. How could she be appreciative of this? But in his mind, you know, they had been very good to her.
This is the moment where we understand slave owners like the Washingtons imagining themselves as what they would call benevolent slaveholders. You know, I'm still sort of trying to figure out what that means. You know, what does it mean to be a benevolent slave owner? And, you know, the Washingtons felt that because she was in the household, because she may have had nicer clothing than perhaps those who worked agriculturally, because she perhaps had more food to eat, that they had actually done her a favor. And one of the things that I'm very clear about in the book is that to be an enslaved person living in the household of your owner created a whole other set of difficulties and impediments, and she was basically on the clock 24/7. She was to be on duty at all times. Whereas those who, you know, had very difficult jobs working on the in the fields of Mount Vernon, whether they were growing tobacco or wheat, they lived in the quarters. They lived away from their owners. They had a moment to be among themselves, to laugh, to love, to be apart from their slave owners. Ona did not have that space. She was constantly under the microscope of George and Martha Washington. So whenever they had a sort of difficult moment or may have had a sort of difficult temper, Ona was there and would have been first in line to receive that anger. And so what I try to do with this book and with Ona's life is to dismiss this understanding that to be an enslaved person working in the household, you know, that was an easier job than someone working in the field. That doesn't help us, that kind of easier or harder or whatever. You know, slavery was slavery, and your responsibilities were different. And also, the labor within the household was very physical. To be able to wash clothing in the 18th century was extremely physically demanding, to make your soap from lye, to gather water, to bring it to the household, to put it over a fire, to stir the clothing, to shake them out, to iron, dry them, and dye. This was very difficult, time-consuming labor. And Ona's life shows us what it meant to be an enslaved person working in a domestic capacity in the home for the most well-known family in the nation.
I was impressed with her ability to outwit some of the folks he had on her trail.
You know, it's this moment where you realize just how resourceful this 22-year-old enslaved woman is, resisting the president of the United States, and manages to remain detached from the Washingtons. But there's also a moment where you step back and you watch what the president actually did to try and capture his fugitive. And it's this moment, George Washington signs the first fugitive slave law in 1793, which gives slave owners the right to travel across state lines to retrieve their human property. But there were laws and rules that had to be followed in order for this to take place. Lawyers had to be involved in identification process. Sent fugitives had to be brought in front of magistrates in order to move through a process of returning a fugitive. George Washington was unwilling to do any of this. He wanted this to be done as discreetly as possible. And so this is a moment where we see the first president of the United States actually breaking the law. He's breaking the fugitive slave law. He is not interested in following the rules and the conduct that was to happen. He wanted to get Ona Judge back as quickly, as inexpensively as possible. And for this to happen, he begins this pursuit of her towards the end of his time in office. And so he's unwilling to have any sort of bad publicity about moving across state lines to capture this young woman in a state that was really, for the most part, New Hampshire, starting to become very uncomfortable with this idea of human bondage. And so for that reason and others, George Washington makes the decision to pursue her relentlessly, but he's not following the law.
She got married and she had children, but from what you describe of her life, it sounds like she had a very hard life and was so poor. Did she ever regret leaving the Washingtons?
You know, Ona's life, once she runs away, is far from easy. And in many ways, Ona's life represents the lives of countless others who managed to escape the jaws of slavery and who were never free. You know, the reason why the book is called Never Caught is because she was not free. She was never free. She lived as a fugitive for nearly half a century. But she lived, she made the decision to live by her own design, to choose her husband, something she would not have been able to do as an enslaved person, to have children. And of course, those children would, according to the law, be fugitives as well. They were owned by Martha Washington's estate, even though her husband was a free man. Slavery followed the apron strings of its women. And so, although her life really was, she was forced to live in the shadows for nearly half a century, she never regretted her decision. Yes, she was impoverished. Yes, her life was difficult. And I think, to, you know, in many ways, her difficulties are very symbolic of what other men and women who had run from slavery, the lives that they had to live. But she's very clear in the interviews that she gives at the end of her life that, she, you know, she would know. She did not regret the decisions that she had made, that it was one that she would do again if she had to, and that although she lived the life as a fugitive, looking over her shoulder, knowing that she could be captured and taken into slavery, back into slavery, now with her children, that this was a heavy, heavy burden to carry her entire life. But she would do it again if she had to make that decision.
After hearing about this story, I think I heard about it, maybe it was a year ago, I started hearing about the story. And ever since I've heard about it and read about it, I've really had a different opinion about George Washington. I'm not saying I think he was all bad, but his very he was so conniving and really just, I think, cruel in his pursuit of this person that it's quite disturbing, actually.
I think that it's disturbing because we fashion George Washington in a certain way. We fashion him as the first president of the United States. He's someone who, in our history books, we revere. And while he was someone who did and went to great lengths to help build the nation, to fight and win the American Revolution, it doesn't mean that we can't understand him as a complex man, but more specifically as a slaveholder. And he's someone who held slaves for the entirety of his life. He was born into a slaveholding family. He inherited them at a young age. And over his lifetime, he did begin to question the legitimacy of slavery. There were moments where he wrote about, you know, his sort of discomfort as a slave owner and that he wished to, at some point, get rid of his slaves. He never did that while he was alive. He made the decision to live with slave labor, to benefit from slave labor. However, at the end of his life, in his will, he did emancipate his enslaved men and women. His will stated that upon the death of Martha, that his slaves would be set free. And so I think for many reasons, we sort of see this as a way to sort of celebrate George Washington, perhaps his enlightenment, perhaps his discomfort with slavery. And I think we have to acknowledge that. But the other part of this story is that he never did that while he was alive. He only did in death what he would not do while he was living. He had set his slaves free upon the death of his wife. And I also think it's important to mention that in the 18th century, to emancipate slaves, you know, that was a tremendous amount of wealth to let go of. George Washington had no biological children. So there were no sons or daughters who would be expecting an inheritance. He and Martha Washington had no biological children. She had children from her first marriage, but not with him. And so, you know, I asked the question, how likely would George Washington have been to emancipate over 120 people upon his death, to basically give that wealth away, flush it away, if he had had children? You know, so I think that there are parts about George Washington, parts of his life, that we have to wrestle with as a nation if we really want a clear and complicated vision of this first president. Then we have to grapple with the fact that he was a slave owner, and he was a slave owner who pursued his slaves, others who had run off prior to Ona, as well as Ona Judge. He literally pursued her until his death. And that's a statement that I think we have to reckon with as a nation, as we think about the issues of race and slavery, race that comes from a nation built upon slavery.
And that was Erica Armstrong Dunbar, the author of Never Caught, The Washington's Relentless Pursuit of Their Runaway Slave, Ona Judge. Armstrong Dunbar is the Blue and Gold Distinguished Professor of Black Studies and History at the University of Delaware. You're listening to The Exchange here on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. This week, the annual Rivercade celebration continues downtown and along the riverfront, featuring a parade, sports, entertainment, and a smile contest, among other things. I talked with Rivercade spokesman Gary Lewis and Phil Clayes about what will be going on at this year's festival.
It started in 64 with a bunch of chamber members and other business people got together and thought, let's celebrate our connection with the river, the barge traffic, as well as the quality of life that we all have here in the Siouxland area. So like I say, this is our 55th year. We've got 22 events coming up, and we're just here to share the word and let people know what's going on this year for Rivercade 2018.
We've got the bowling tournament out at Brushworks, and it'll be July 13th, 14th, and 15th. That's Friday, Saturday, Sunday. And after that, we got helicopter rides coming up on July 13th through the 15th. Then the car show on Saturday the 14th, which is out at the Hy-Vee at Southern Hills Mall. And then one of my favorite events, because I get to be part of it, is the Rivercade Smile Contest, which I like to call a smile show, because there is no contest when these little kids, I get to emcee that, and when these kids start smiling, there's no contest. They're all winners, and that is for ages 4 to 12. It's free, and registration starts at 1:30, and that is at Southern Hills Mall, and judging will begin at 2 o'clock. And judging sounds so judgmental.
It's not judgmental.
And that's a center court out of Southern Hills
Mall.
Yep,
center court, 4 to 12.
Yep, come on.
And that's one of my favorites. Yeah. The kids are just make it all so much fun for me.
Yep, smiling, happy children, you know.
You still have the boat parade.
Oh, well, that's coming up. That's coming up. Of course we do.
Can we keep going?
Yes.
All right, I'll keep going here. What the heck? We got the Rivercade Kenefler Show and Shine Cookout 5 to 7. That's on the
14th.
These are all the 14th right
Saturday
now.
The 14th.
So we got the Show and Shine and Cookout 5 to 7, followed by Cruise the Loop, and that'll be at Kenefler?
Yeah, the cookout's at Kenefler after they're at the Hy-Vee. They go down to Kenefler, have something to eat, show their cars off, talk, and then we cruise the loop at 7.
And then, still on the 14th, we got a volleyball tournament at Jim's Lounge, just down the street from y'all here. This is a new one. It's the second one. I didn't know about it. Annual foot golf tournament. What's foot golf?
Well, it's out at Sun Valley, and they have holes, and you kick the ball. We had it last year, and they had a great turnout for it, and it's a tournament. It's a foot golf. You golf by kicking the ball, and it's a rarity, but it's a great and fun time.
Then there's the second annual skateboard tournament. We're still on the 14th. This is one full day on the 14th.
Yeah, no, it truly
skateboard
is.
Tournament. The theme this year is the 80s, so dress up, you know, in your 80s clothes.
I still am.
Me too. People say, where do you buy your vintage clothes?
My closet.
Well, I bought them at Sadoff years ago, you know. Yeah. As you've heard from Gary's, is that, you know, we have a lot of activities, a lot of variety. They're all fun. Most of them are free. And that's a tradition of Rivercade. And here we are in our 55th year, and we thank Sioux City for supporting and our sponsors for supporting the activities, because we create fun. And this year is no exception to that. We have a lot of really fun and cool activities. The schedule, as I say, can be seen on the Rivercade website. The Journal will be running, you know, a lot of activity this week with the media. But yeah, 55th year, it's your party, gang.
What, you know, the 55 years, that's a long time. Why do you think that this has been sustained over all that time? Because, you know, local festivals come and go.
Well, it's like you said before we started here, that when I was a kid growing up in Rock Rapids, when I'd see the Rivercade Parade on TV, you couldn't tell me that was any different than the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade. That was huge stuff to me. And the river, this town wouldn't exist without that river. And it's that, you know, spirit of thanking, you know, the river or whatever, you know, honoring the river for being such a part of our community. I think that makes it a very important celebration for the area.
And, you know, the other thing, too, is that everybody wishes things were the way they used to be.
Right.
And I wish it was the way it was in the 60s,
it's not down by the
70s,
river
the 80s. But the city made the decision to move us down to Chautauqua Park years ago. So we developed Chautauqua Park as an area. Then we got moved again. But we didn't get moved anywhere. Since then, we've just kind of been gypsies because we couldn't have things along the riverfront for various reasons. We've tried to off and on. And this year, we're back on the riverfront for some of the activities. We have been for 4 years. Having music and that and fireworks on the riverfront. And, you know, the parade is still a very popular. Thousands of people come to it. And, you know, so we have sustained simply because there's a lot of us that really believe in Rivercade and really believe in the tradition of celebrating Sioux City, because we're the signature celebration of Sioux City. There's other things, and some are bigger and some are greater, but we're the signature celebration of Sioux City, Rivercade is. And we've kept it going because of the support and sponsorships, and that's why it still is here today.
I was just talking with Rivercade spokesman Phil Clayes and Gary Lewis about the Rivercade Festival that's going on now and through the weekend in downtown Sioux City and along the river. That's it for this week's edition of The Exchange. I'm Mary Hartnett. We'll see you next week.